I wonder, in 2020, where that group of young people will be. And indeed, in 2020, after 14 years of this program, where all the people that have been involved in it will be. Perhaps we'll have more than 100,000 at that stage that will have come through this tremendous program. So thank you so much for Dr. Inga Russell's hard work, and all the people who participate in the judging and all of the administration that goes into this program. So where will they be? What will they achieve? Can we glimpse their future yet? And hopefully today was a small step into thinking about what they will be able to do in their careers, how they can bring us forward in this wonderful world. And certainly, it is a wonderful world where there are opportunities for education. Education is about a search for knowledge. It's about an inbuilt curiosity that we all have. And it is indeed about those opportunities that Inga mentioned. Well, there was a gentleman, I put his name up here because you might not recognize him, named Dr. Pierce Lyons, and he traveled for that opportunity because of that curiosity. He went after his graduation from University College Dublin, here with his brother Kevin. After that graduation, he decided he wanted to go further. He wanted to pursue more education. He wanted greater opportunities. And he traveled to Birmingham, and he studied what we all saw this week to be one of his great passions, brewing. And after completing his master's, he went on to a PhD. He was a man on the move. And he drove all over the UK in his first job over there, selling yeast, selling enzymes, visiting different ethanol plants. But that really wasn't a big enough opportunity for him. He wanted to seek out more things. He wanted to get to know the world. He wanted those opportunities. So he brought his young family to a place that I hope all of you have been able to enjoy this week. But I can say it was very different, the Kentucky that we moved to, than the Kentucky of today. It was certainly the bluegrass state, but many of the big buildings we see, much of the vibrant atmosphere that exists in downtown Lexington today, wasn't there. And indeed, I think for my mother, a city girl who grew up in Dublin, then lived in the lovely town of Ludlow in Shropshire, came to Lexington, and she was a bit amiss. It would be amiss of me to say that she fell over herself in happiness about Kentucky. But that place has transformed, and indeed those two people have done all they can in the country and in the state that they picked. I often think that if somebody immigrates to a place, they chose that place, and they often have a deeper love for it than even those who were born there. So the years go on, and we've seen some of the things that have happened. The founding of Alltech, the founding of a business, the founding of a great dream. The symposium in those days was a little bit different. Dr. Lyons reading the questions out. Probably one of our panel discussions was bigger than the first symposiums this week. Actually, in the first symposiums, my mother cooked all the food. I think that went on for 3 or 4 or 5 years. Dr. Lyons was the grill master, cooking up the steaks. And he also signed every single textbook. He actually continued that on until we stopped having the textbooks about 5 years ago. So he came to Kentucky with a mission. He came to Kentucky for the opportunity. But he really wanted to do something that would make a difference. And in founding Alltech and being able to be involved in this community and the reward that's come back to him from this community, that has been a great dream and I think a great example of leadership that we can all learn from. This was our first research facility, the research farm, a very big step for Alltech as we move forward. Today, on that same site, we have our Nutrigenomics Center, which many of you have learned about this week, could hold the key to solving so many of the food and agricultural issues, and indeed even human health issues, that exist in our society. The All-Tech FEI World Equestrian Games was certainly something that transformed All-Tech, and it certainly transformed Kentucky. A very special event, and something that put All-Tech on the map and put Kentucky on the map in a way that had never been before. I hope many of you were able to visit the newest distillery in the world, the newest bourbon in the world, the Town Branch. When we first bought the brewery, which is now Kentucky Ale, the Lexington City Brewing Company, the oldest brewery in Kentucky by far, brewing was not something, and craft beer was not something that you would see in this part of the world. It was described to me early on as a Bubba market. This was Anheuser-Busch, this was Miller, this was Coors. Now we can already see how much has changed. Since 1980, which was the low watermark for the number of breweries in the U.S., it got down all the way to 77, there are now 2,600 breweries in the United States. So a very exciting thing, and something I think that indicates what consumers are looking for. Authenticity, something unique, something they can have an experience with. This is our newest doctor, Dr. Deirdre Lyons. And I would say the big vision and the big ideas of All-Tech certainly come from Dr. Pierce Lyons. But the image, and probably much more importantly, the values of All-Tech are those of Dr. Deirdre Lyons. So this is a very proud moment on Saturday when she received this honorary doctorate from the University of Pikeville. Leaders inspire through their passion, through their vision. They also create space. Earlier this week, Dr. Lyons mentioned that he feels his role is to create space for young people, to create the space for them to thrive. And this is a tremendous world to go and explore. And all of us in our leadership capacities should be trying to make that space for people. It's a wonderful world when you have the opportunity to move to China. I hope that gave you a little bit of an idea of some of the fun we were having in China. I have to say, it is one of the most fantastic places, and I've really enjoyed the experience and the opportunity to live in China and to be part of the culture. We talk about the rise of the East, and I have to say, the other thing that has been incredible is the amount of interest people have about this country. Certainly, we have seen an incredible economic story. Just in the short life of All-Tech, probably the greatest economic story in the history of man. The economy and the place that we see today looks nothing like it did even 5-10 years ago. Going away for something like the symposium is a bit dangerous. You might be back, there might be a new building right in front of where your apartment is. There might be new highways. The pace of growth is something that you can really only understand, I'd actually say, living there, or going back on a very regular basis. We get all the time constant questions. What is happening in China? What is going to happen? What will the impact be? And it's because there really is no place in the world that in 2020 and beyond is going to impact the rest of the world more. There is so much excitement about what's going on, and at the same time, quite a bit of concern. So how do we demystify China? How do we help China with the challenges that it has? That's very much what we see as our responsibility. China is really just at the beginning, early stages of food consumption. By 2015, it will only be spending per capita half of what Mexico spends today. So the growth that we're going to see will be carrying on for a number of years. But there are many challenges in our way to get there. The total population of the United States, the equivalent of that, will be moving from rural communities to cities. Right now, 50% of the Chinese population lives in cities. It will be 70% by 2030. They'll be the largest middle class in the world, and they will require 50% more meat, milk, and eggs than they consume today. They will also be a lot more picky. Indeed, I would say they already are, about what is in their food and how it is produced. On my first business meeting, when I moved to China, I had dinner. Basically, every meeting you have in China is probably going to include a meal. That's how important food is. That's how important relationships are. And at the end, I was getting dropped off at my hotel, and the gentleman I was with said, "Mark, you need to understand, China is fantastic. Anything is possible. But also, everything can be difficult. It isn't something for everyone. It isn't a place for everyone. You have to have stamina. You have to be committed." But as I mentioned, the pace of change is unlike anything I believe we've ever seen. Not just unique to this moment, but unique perhaps in history. But food plays a vital role in the society, and it plays a vital role in politics. Food security is seen as a critical issue. The Chinese government believes it must control its food supply, or else it will put itself at risk. At the same time, we hear many stories about food safety. This is the major concern for consumers. And with the advent of the internet, which has been an incredible, I would say, success story, and maybe the internet and social media is even more important in China than any other country, food safety is really getting pushed to the top of the list of priorities. Food safety can be openly discussed. Food safety issues are on the news, they're in newspapers, they're on Weibo, they're on WeChat all the time. And why is that? I started to think about this, and I realized when we think of the media around the world, there's so many different topics to talk about. We've got politics, we've got celebrities, we've got sports, we have so many different topics. But many of these topics in China are not talked about in the media, maybe not allowed in the media. So that means that food and agriculture rises to be much more important, take a disproportionate amount of media time than it would otherwise. At the same time, you never eat alone in China. Food is so important in China, it's part of almost every conversation. So the Chinese government creates a five-year plan. And these five-year plans give an indication to the population, to businesses, and to the global community where China is going. And this five-year plan focused almost entirely in terms of the agriculture sector at making things more efficient, making them larger, making them more traceable. So all the things that we just heard from Patrick Wall, that is what China is wanting to do. And they want to do it in a big, big hurry. This is a place where people want massive scale because they have to have it for this traceability. The typical sow farmer today, typical pig farmer, probably has less than 10 pigs. At this scale, it's impossible in a country that has half the world's pigs to actually trace where anything is going. So scale is a critical thing. This is totally the reverse, I would imagine, to most of the places where you live, where many people are talking about local, they're talking about small farms, they want to have that connection. China is going in a different direction, perhaps just at a different moment in its development. So food security is an issue we hear about in Africa. Food safety is an issue we hear about Southeast Asia. And food quality is something we hear about in Europe, we hear about in the United States. But all three of these are critical issues to China, and they're happening at the same time. And that's because of the great diversity that you see in this country. I mentioned a minute ago that half the world's pigs live in China, 50 million sows. And the genetics companies have been doing a very good job over the years, and they have been able to bring in import genetics. There's crossbred genetics using the Chinese breeds. So we're getting about 20 pigs per sow per year. So that's a billion pigs. The challenge is that there is so much trouble with disease, there's trouble with population being so close to these animals, that only 600 million end up going to market. So that's 400 million pigs that die somewhere along the way, mainly pre-weaning mortality, mainly as baby pigs. So that means we're really only around 12 pigs per sow per year. So the biggest opportunity that we see in the entire food sector, really, in China, is this problem, is this challenge. Of course, To put that in perspective, the 400 million that we're talking about is 3 times the total production of the United States of pork. Pork is the preferred meat in China. So if we could change that just by one pig per sow per year, get it from 12, 13, 14, 15, we can save 1 million tons of feed at each step. This is critical for the Chinese development. China already has the second largest broiler industry, and we've seen some of the challenges that have taken place this year. Certainly, Yum! Brands in China, a year ago, we would have been talking about as the golden business, really the reference point for foreign companies in China, had a very difficult year this year because of some issues related not only to antibiotic use, but this issue with bird flu. Dairy consumption is on a major rise, and this, again, has been part of a government initiative just to feed the growing population that is moving from rural to urban. You can see that people in urban centers consume a lot more dairy products, almost 3-4 times more than people in rural centers. So just this population move means that we're going to need about 2.5 times the production of New Zealand by 2030. So that isn't going to come from one place. That's certainly an opportunity for virtually every dairy-producing country in the world, and certainly a big opportunity for the dairy sector in China. One thing that I think is a little bit under the radar right now is the fact that through the one-child policy, through many different factors, the Chinese population is starting to age quite significantly. By 2020, we'll have the equivalent, about 325 million people in China over the age of 55. Their decisions will be different. And of course, in Chinese society, it's so important that children take care of their parents. So this will affect not only them, but the next generations. This is something to very much keep an eye on. So when I went to China in January last year, I talked with the team, and I found a wonderful group of people that really wanted to make an impact. But we decided we had to change what we were doing. We had to lay out a new course. We had to change the equation. We knew there were challenges and there were great difficulties in the Chinese market. And in there, we also saw that there could be opportunities. These two characters separately mean danger and opportunity. When put together, they mean crisis. And certainly, we have lived through many crises, looking and seeing what our customers are doing. And that is our opportunity to be able to help them. On the Kentucky night, you might have seen some people running around with this hat or this on their shirt. This is a concept, an umbrella, if you will, that we put over all the projects that we were doing. We're saying now is the time to be in China. Now is the time to make that impact. I liken this to an egg. The shell of the egg is not yet hard, but in 3 or 5 years it will be. We can get in to that egg today, we can do things that we won't be able to do in the future. So that's why it's so important, and that's why we have this initiative. We want to understand China, we want to have an impact on how it is developing, we want to introduce it to the world. So what is our 5-year plan? We want to be a foreign brand, but with a Chinese heart. We want to create market leadership in all the sectors that we're involved in. We want to create networks throughout the various different areas that we're involved in. We want to make sure that we communicate. We communicate, obviously, within China. We communicate outside of China. We do all that we can to improve that communication issue, which is certainly something that hampers our success. You saw in the video a lot of different exciting things. Leona, our colleague, giving a talk about the Altec Young Scientist Award. Dr. Neil, signing a research agreement. This research alliance that we've created is totally unique. 4 universities, 1 institute, Altec involved with all of them, but they are talking together. And they're talking about what are the big challenges? Where are the things that we need to focus our research dollars on? What are the big problems that China is facing and will face? We've brought a lot of people to China. We're trying to make sure that we can provide the answers and created a number of very big meetings. We have about 10 meetings a year that would have over 200 people in them. And so this is a part of our initiative, part of the marketing through education that, of course, has always been the Altec program. So we have to use our global knowledge and our connections to help the industry over the barriers that it has. And it's leveraging those relationships. In this example, our third dairy symposium, bringing experts from around the world to be able to interact and answer questions to dairy producers in China. So those have been some of our choices. And what will the impact of those choices be? Hopefully, Alltech will be able to play a role in making food safer, making it more abundant, making China, in a lot of respects, more self-sufficient. My big concern, to be honest, is China has a lot of money. If China cannot produce its food efficiently, China can buy it from someone else or can source it from someone else. That may actually mean that it will have a bigger impact on some of the poorer countries in the world and their ability to feed their populations. So it's very, very important that we solve this problem within China as much as we can. Now, you might say, that sounds like an awfully big thing. This gentleman wrote a poem about something that couldn't be done. And I'm going to try and give you three stories about three Chinese men who are facing challenges, I believe, where many could say this couldn't be done. Our first is a dairy farmer in Heilongjiang province in the northern part of China. He's been working at this for quite some time, actually 10 years. And he started into dairy because he saw there was a push by the government saying, we want more dairy for our young people. We want to make sure that they have dairy products. We want to make sure that they have the ability to buy half a liter of milk. But he also knows that food safety is a major concern and that confidence from the consumer can impact his business. We've seen that with the melamine scandal in 2008, milk dropped completely off some people's diets. So his big dream is to have 1,000 dairy cows and to own a BMW. He started with just 40 cows. And now he has 250. And he faces probably a very big decision. Because at 250, he's really not viable in this new Chinese model. He has to have probably at least 300, and then he's just going to be getting by. Because the government wants scale. All of the processors need to know where their milk comes from, right down to the farm level. And these are the new regulations being imposed on them by the government. So, last week his neighbor moved to the city and got a job in the factory. And he sent him a text message saying he probably can do the same. What will he decide? Will he decide to stay on the farm and invest and take the risk and follow his dream? Or will he quit and move to the city? He needs finance. He needs equipment. He needs education. He needs management. He needs training. And a big, big problem in China, he needs land and he's not going to get it. Probably the one thing that is holding back the dairy industry in China more than anything else is the fact that they can't spray manure the way every other country can. So these types of things are really playing in his mind. He has to think about that equipment and think about where he can get that education. And of course, he's still thinking about the BMW. So what does he decide to do? Well, it's really going to come down to one thing. Does he have the courage to follow his dream? And does he have the courage when there's major movements going on? Just in the last couple of weeks, some things have happened that were a little bit anticipated. One was definitely anticipated, the other one not so much. Danone has bought part of Mengyu. They made a deal with COFCO. Mengyu is one of the largest dairy processors in China. For a long time, it was rumored that Mengyu would buy part of the largest dairy company in China, Modern Dairy, and that happened 2 weeks before. So now we're starting to see something I don't think we've ever seen anywhere in the world. You essentially have a totally integrated dairy model developing, and this is certainly just the first step. So what we've decided to do is to invest in the educational part. We believe the education of the entire dairy sector is really the game changer in this model. And we feel we have a unique ability to play a role in that. So we have joined up with several companies headed up by Nestle to create a dairy farming institute. This dairy farming institute will be a reference point for Chinese dairy farming. Our second example is the biggest internet mogul you've never heard of. This guy has done incredible things in a very short amount of time. But I would imagine for most of you, it's the first time you've seen his face, and it's probably the first time you've heard Ma Yun's name. He started the first e-commerce business. He actually started the first business of any type on the internet in 1995. This e-commerce business was started in an apartment, and these were their founders. And in just 6 years, they became the leader in their field, serving 50,000 different members. They're trading now in 200 countries, and their own part of the revenue is already $10 billion. And it's called Alibaba.com. This is essentially an eBay that goes well beyond what we would anticipate eBay to be doing. But many people doubted that he could actually achieve this. But he had the courage, and he said, "You cannot control what other people say about you. You just know where you will go and the social value you can create." And I think it's because of that belief in social value and the belief that he was doing something that was crucially important for the Chinese population and many other countries as well, that is why he has been successful. They just surpassed, in terms of trading, 1 trillion RMB. That is $130 billion. That's the equivalent of the GDP of Kuwait. With the growth that they're seeing, their trading capacity will surpass the GDP of Ireland next year. Totally amazing in terms of taking an idea that he had when he visited the United States in 1994, bringing it back to China, and having the courage of his convictions to follow that dream. So, what would you do at that point? You're 45. You've had a success. He retired. And he retired in a way I've never seen anybody retire before. I think Dr. Lyons, I probably shouldn't have put this slide up, because if he ever does retire, this is probably the way he'd want to do it. He's not going to retire anyway, is he? 35,000 people in attendance. A stadium. It rained. They all stayed. They cheered. They were excited. And he talked about what he wants to do next. He wants to focus on two things: education and the environment. Because he said these are the two things now that China needs. He's retired 7 years earlier than Bill Gates. Certainly more to do with Bill Gates' generosity, or as much as Alibaba's growth. It's likely that he will be richer than Bill Gates by 2020. What is he going to do? What decisions will he make? Our third example is the new leader of China, Xi Jinping. He has been talking about something called the Chinese Dream. And it's been a very, very powerful message in China. He is asking the Chinese nation to dream, to think big. He hasn't really defined yet what that dream is. But we can see from many of his actions where the indications are. His first trip abroad was to Russia. Russia, of course, is a very important trading partner for China. We're also seeing a lot of Chinese farmers already going into parts of Russia that Russians have left, particularly in the eastern part of the country. So he went there to make sure that he could solidify things. And I think this is very important for the Westerners, for all of us to think about. The most important thing for him was to solidify those relationships. He didn't go in with a political agenda. He didn't have points that he was going to negotiate when he went to Russia. He went to make sure that they felt respected, that they felt that there was a strong relationship and they were important. The next place he went was Africa. And in Africa, he said to the people there, "You and I, the Chinese people and the African people, have both suffered. We have a brotherhood through this. And we need to be aligned. We need to be allies. And we have just gone through this development process in China, and we will share this with you." This is being seen as a very generous step by Xi Jinping, and it's being received in a very positive way. So I asked our young colleagues, I asked one of them in particular, she studied in Ireland, did her master's degree, actually with Professor McLaughlin. And I said, what do you think of when you think of Xi Jinping? And she said one word, hope. He gives us hope. And of course, we had seen that similar slogan recently in this country. So Xi Jinping, I believe, for the young people in China, and I would almost say for the entire population, is bringing them a hope that they maybe didn't see before. Very charismatic leader, but I believe a lot of big decisions in front of him. Today, this is a lot of what we see in the media. Is China going to rise? Is it going to surpass America? And when I talk to my customers, they don't understand. They often wonder, why do Americans not see China as the greatest market opportunity that they have? Why do they see it as a rival? So perhaps when these two men meet in June, as they will in California, both of them can be thinking in a hopeful way and can be thinking how these two countries could come together. Because we know that by 2020, we are going to have two other politicians running for office against each other. But we also know Xi Jinping will still be running China. So these types of things are important to think about as we think of how to deal with the rise of China. If somehow they could come together and we could have the two most powerful countries in the world trying to make a more peaceful and a more sustainable world, I certainly think we'd be in a better place. And one of the reasons for that is this. We've seen some very interesting things in the news recently on carbon. But the total emissions of China will be equal to those of Europe and the United States by 2020. This is a major challenge. And I can tell you, living in China, people always ask me, is it really true what's on the news? Is the air really that bad? And I think, if anything, one of the great things about the air is that everybody breathes the same air. So if this is affecting people on the street, it's also affecting politicians. And we see real change coming about. We see real discussion about having green energy, having a green revolution. And I believe by 2020, China will be looking very different at this issue. Not sure if many of you have ever seen this man, Mohamed Nasheed. He was the president of the Maldives, and he was the first man, just in his first month of office, he said, we will be the first country to commit to sustainability. And he spent a lot of time trying to convince other leaders to do the same. Well, what if part of the China dream was to be the most sustainable country in the world? How much would that change the rest of the world that we live in? Because we've seen that CO2 levels in the atmosphere have now surpassed 400 parts per million, a level that was very much a barometer for scientists for a long time. At the turn of the last century, 1900, we would have been around 250 parts per million. So something is happening, and it's happening very, very quickly. When the captain of the Titanic had the opportunity to turn his ship around, had he been able to see the iceberg in front of him, he could have moved that massive ship and he could have avoided that terrible tragedy. That is where we stand today. We probably still have a small chance of slowing down climate change, but we have to realize it's a Titanic that we are driving, and we have to change the way we think fundamentally to be able to do this. By 2020, climate change will be irreversible. It will affect all of us, and it will probably have terrible consequences in terms of war, poverty, hunger. So how will that impact choices you make? What is it that you can do? Sustainability, to me, is often talked about as a technological issue. Indeed, feeding the world is seen as a technological issue. I think that's ridiculous. This is an ethical issue. We have to ethically decide if this is something that we are willing to include in our decision-making. So if it couldn't be done, I believe it certainly could be. I think if we can change the way we think in this wonderful world, and as Dr. Lyons has asked us, live up to our greatness, we can solve these problems. Economic growth should not be the only measurement of success. And unfortunately, normally on an individual basis, and definitely on a country basis, it's what we think about. Short-term thinking is driving way too many decisions today. For public companies, quarterly earnings are basically what everything is based on. We have to be thinking longer term. And also, if we're shareholders in those companies, we need to be pushing those companies to be thinking that way. Is all progress positive? Or should we be deciding that some progress should be included and some is actually negative for us? We don't want to end up in what is called the progress trap. This constant growth, more and more and more, and actually a society that is not as good as it previously was. In economics, they talk about things called externalities. They make equations, and they talk about how every factor that comes into a scenario can be included. And then if there's something that doesn't fit in the equation, they call it an externality. One of the externalities that is normally referred to in economics is the environment. And I think one of the most important things that needs to take place is realizing that that is not an externality. We are passing costs forward. We are putting ourselves at great, great risk. A fish isn't aware that it's living in water, but that water, of course, is so vital to its life. We have the ability to be aware of what we are doing to our planet and to start to take steps to avoid that. So I believe by 2020, we won't be just thinking about products in terms of costs. We will really be thinking about them in terms of their benefits. And I also think to be able to register products, to actually be able to sell products in the market, we are going to have to be able to prove the environmental impact that they have when we produce them. It is a wonderful world, but the gap between rich and poor between 2008 and 2010 grew as much as it had previously grown in the previous decade. Of course, a lot of this has to do with the financial crisis. The financial crisis hurt the poorest people the most. How are we going to challenge our world? How are we going to be leaders to close that gap? Because indeed, not only is this an ethical or moral issue, it also makes our world a lot less safe. We have 1 billion hungry people in the world. We have 1 billion with what we call hidden hunger. They're missing nutrients. They don't have enough to eat. At the same time, we have still this issue of obesity. In our food session this week, we had a great discussion. We had a member of a retailer, somebody from a restaurant, we had local food, we had a scientist, we had a consumer advocate. And we talked about this issue, that we have to make sure the food industry doesn't end up where the tobacco industry ended up. For those of you from Kentucky, this is very near and dear to your heart. And certainly, that is where we're going, that food is starting to be demonized, it's starting to have the finger pointed at it for a myriad of ills. And I think a lot of that comes down to the way we structure businesses. I know many people here who make their decisions based on really what their consumer wants, and they have great businesses because of that. But most of the time, our businesses are compartmentalized, and our thinking is compartmentalized. Professor Eugenia Wang talked about this, and she said, we can't be thinking about things just as doctors. I have to be thinking about nutrition. I have to be thinking about the way people live. And this is certainly a big challenge for us. But I think the fact that we are such social beings and we like to talk to each other, we need to break these barriers down and be doing just that. So what a wonderful world that by 2020 will be even more transparent than it is today. And I think this transparency is critical to breaking this compartmentalized thinking. Social media is having a major, major impact. It does change everything, and it changes it again, as Steve Jobs said. But that information that we have today will not be at our fingertips in 2020. It'll be at the blink of an eye. We've seen the Google Glasses coming out, the impact that that's going to have in terms of the information that people can receive. They will simply look at a product, and they'll have every single piece of information that they would want about it. How does that change the way we do things? How does that change the way we act and the way we perform in our businesses? So all of these things that we talk about as social medias, these are simply tools. Social media is the community. And I think one of the most important things for all of us in our businesses, in our lives, is to engage with that social media, engage with those people. They have a lot of curiosity. They want information. And for most of us, we're not comfortable with this type of media, so we don't want to engage them. And the only thing that will happen then is they will be educated and informed by someone else. But what a wonderful world where we have so many tremendous leaders. Certainly this week, 2,500 great leaders in one place, interacting, discussing. This is a wonderful thing. And I think the responsibility that all of us have now is to go back and create more leaders. Share the messages we heard this week. Share the ideas. Followers focus on money. They focus on power. Leaders really change things, and they want to change things. And those are the people that we need to be talking to our young people. I met the gentleman who wrote this book, Gen Y, Your Business, and he was talking about how you have to engage with young people, the people coming into the workforce today, in a totally different manner than you did in the past. You have to really explain to them why they're doing what they're doing, why is it important. And if you do so, you will get great results. Because the companies that are doing this really are able to separate themselves and get great value from this new workforce. So it's one great life that we want to share. And what is it that people are looking to us for? Well, when we think about companies, we had our great entrepreneurial session, and you can see most companies start in that area. And I think one of the critical success factors for all businesses is how you can maintain that. As Professor McLaughlin said, you have to keep the founder's mentality. But keeping that entrepreneurial spirit alive is so critical. We then have the management stage of development. Very important. How do we organize our business efficiently? But then, I think, unfortunately, most of us fall into bureaucracy. And the bureaucracy ties us up. And after that, the only thing is the death of the company. So I think it's critical to continue to remember, keep that entrepreneurial spirit alive, and keep that management well organized. Don't trickle into bureaucracy and death. And that's how we can have that world of trust. If we interact with our consumers, if we create and gain their approval, gain their trust, then we will have success. This will be the critical factor by 2020. We need to make sustainability part of our equation. We need to know the virtue, know the real purpose of our business. We need to seek that active engagement. We need to embrace technology, embrace change, and we should bring integrity to everything we do. I believe these are the five critical factors that will determine success and failure for 2020. You must love what you do. We've heard this many times in the symposium. If you don't love your job, get another one. Love what you do and love your people. These are important things for us for success. Don't try to be someone of success. Try to be someone of value. So when we think about It Couldn't Be Done, and we think about this great poem, that somebody said it couldn't be done, but he with a chuckle replied that maybe it couldn't, but he'd be the one who wouldn't say so till he tried. So he buckled right in with a trace of a grin on his face. If he worried he hit it, he started to sing as he tackled the thing that couldn't be done, and he did it. Somebody scoffed, "Oh, you'll never do that. At least no one has done it." But he took off his coat, and he took off his hat, and the first thing we knew, he'd begun it. With a lift of his chin and a bit of a grin, without any doubting or quitting, he started to sing as he tackled the thing that couldn't be done, and he did it. So I would say to you, just start to sing as you tackle the thing that couldn't be done, and you'll do it. This is the wonderful world we live in. This is the opportunity we have. If we have the courage to do the thing that can't be done, then we will wake up to our greatness. Thank you so much.
Get out of here.
Questions?
Mark. Somebody asked me, why did I send Mark to China? The reason I sent Mark to China is I can't handle the competition. That's why I sent him over there. Mark, how difficult is it living in China?
Actually, I don't. I think it's, as I mentioned, I don't think it's for everyone. I think if you like a different culture, you like to have those experiences and challenges, then I think it's a fantastic place.
Okay.
I think there's a lot of people. There's a lot going on, and there's a lot of investment now going into education, trying to actually get more people to China. So I think that we're going to see a lot more of that in the future, probably a lot more foreigners. The government has actually just changed visas, so you can have a 5-year visa because they have this hunger for overseas expertise.
Mark, we have these countries, these emerging countries, and China is but one of them. What about places like India?
I think the opportunities...
And when are you going there? And incidentally, Mark, I hate to tell you, but there are arranged marriages there. My friends from Saguna, they have 2 daughters and very attractive, and they come with a dowry.
Right. So I think that there's a lot of opportunities in many, many countries. India, certainly, there's fantastic development that's going to take place.
Okay. Okay, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.